Hey guys, it's Nick Dobe of Random Ramblings of a Demented Doorknob.
Travis McCollum of the Movie Encyclopedia.
And this is the Demented Encyclopedia.
Hey everybody, and welcome to the special 13th edition of the Demented Encyclopedia. Today, because 13 is such a lucky number, we will be going over the illustrious and very colorful career of one Uwe Boll. Now, if you've been paying attention to Nick's side and my side, but mostly Nick's because his is more official, we've both been doing kind of a week of Uwe Boll, and we're not doing that because we've lost our minds. We're doing it because it's all leading up to this. My and Nick's discussion of probably one of the most controversial, or at least one of the most talked about directors I've seen in a long time. But before we get into that discussion, Nick and I are going to talk about some plugs and recommend whatnot. So what do you got, Nick?
All right. For a while now, I've been really trying to look for just a good book that I could actually get through, because for the longest time now, I've been having trouble actually getting through a book. I'll start all these books and then stop because I just can't get into it. For whatever reason. So again, I went and tried to find another book, and I found this book that's just amazing and hilarious, and it's called Divine Misfortune, and it's about it takes place in kind of this parallel Earth, like modern day Earth, where people can sign up and choose their deity, their god, much like an online dating service. Like, they go on to the website, which is like pantheon.com or .org or whatever, and they just search for different gods, and the gods have, like, sell themselves videos where they talk about their benefits and what they stand for and what kind of sacrifices they need to make in order to follow this specific god or goddess, and that's kind of the basic idea. And the main guy, the main couple, decide that they need a god because they've been kind of down and out, and the wife is kind of against it at first, and but they get over it and search for this god, and they find this luck god who is like who's a raccoon, and the raccoon Luca decides that he's going to live with them if they're going to, you know, follow him. And it's just kind of it's a very funny book so far. I devoured like the first 50 pages in the first little time that I had it, of the first day, and it's I haven't finished it yet, but so far I'd really recommend it.
Okay. While you were talking, I really didn't have one I recommend up, but then I remembered a book that I just finished reading recently, which is Will Grayson, Will Grayson by John Green and David Leviathan, which I'm probably mispronouncing his name, but John Green is kind of famous on YouTube as being one of the Vlog Brothers. He's written a few novels now, mostly young adult fiction, but he really appeals to the nerds in all of us. While David Leviathan, or Leviathan, or however it's pronounced, his only book that I've ever seen him write is Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist, which then was made into a movie. But the idea is that these two authors are writing about two people with the same name, Will Grayson and Will Grayson. One has his name capitalized, one doesn't. One, the first Will Grayson, is an intelligent guy who's just trying to keep, under the radar, but it's made hard by the fact that his best friend Tiny is a really, really big guy who's really, really gay. Actually, the world's gayest person who is really, really large is what they say. And Tiny's trying to bring himself out more and more to other people while Will is trying to attract himself. While on the other hand, Will Grayson, the other one whose name is never capitalized, he does it because he's kind of more angsty, more teeny, I guess, more emo-ish, but he really doesn't have a whole lot good happening with him. And the only friends he really has are his online friends, and especially one with a guy named Isaac. And he's kind of hell-bent on trying to meet this Isaac because he's his closest friend, and yet he's never met him. And they just, when they finally come together, it's something really amazing, and it's a really good book.
All right, then.
All right, now that we've done that, we're gonna get into our main discussion of Uwe Boll. Where to begin, I guess would be a good place to go. He started out kind of no name in Germany, just your kind of average guy who just had dreams of becoming a director. And what happened is he got the opportunity to direct three films, all of which were in Germany, and they were pretty good. But his biggest problem is no one would pay him, and it wasn't because he was bad, it was just because he was a nobody. So his first three films were very, very low budget, and he really couldn't do a whole lot with them. But he had a really good Portrait of a Serial Killer film, a really good political conspiracy film, and then one film was actually half English, half German, and that one kind of sucked because that was his first time ever dealing with American people in terms of his films. And then he decided to go over into American cinema, or more importantly, because he lives in Canada, Canadian cinema, I guess. And he started off with his film Blackwoods, which is like Deliverance meets Texas Chainsaw Massacre. If that film made love to David Fincher. I mean, it's kind of mixing the kind of seven-ish kind of psychological thriller kind of thing, but what makes that film good is that it has, like his other films, a really low budget, not practically nothing like his first couple, but it's very small, and it's his first film with Michael Paré, who, if you know any of his films, Michael Paré's been in just a few Uwe Boll films. Just a few. And when I say that, I mean pretty much almost all of his films. And that's also where he met Clint Howard and a few of his other regulars for the Blackwoods film. And then people were like, oh, this is a pretty good film. All right, now you get to do another film. And he decided, because he was kind of inspired, not in the bad way, but he was inspired by the school shootings, so he created a teen profile film called Heart of America, which was mostly focused on a couple different groups of people, the killers, the students, the teachers, and just them trying to go through their last day of school. And it all ends up with the big school shooting, but it's really good because they really get into some of these characters. And one of the young actors is a young man who's very new to film, whose name is Brendan Fletcher, who would go on to be in a few more of Uwe Boll's films, especially some of what are considered his best films. And then from there, he got thrown a script that said House of the Dead.
This is where I, well, I and most of America first came to know Uwe Boll very well.
Yeah, The sad thing about that is he didn't write it. He really didn't have any control over the film except point the camera here and shoot.
Actually, I was kind of surprised when I was going through this week that for the most part, only up until recently did he not write any of his own movies. Most of them were written by other people, and I don't know if... Because I know directors can have a pretty heavy hand in the screenplay and changing it to fit their own vision. But... so I can't cut him complete slack there. But
no, I'm not trying to just say he's totally, you know, out of any problems that are happening because he was just the director, not the writer, because... There has to be a point when you're looking at the where you're looking through the camera lens and you know it's crap. And he just had to consciously say that. But I think part of his problem was he was kind of newer to American cinema. And I remember in my interview I did with him when he was talking about it is that he was literally just like, here's the script. It's based on a video game. Here you go. Blah, blah, blah. Go, go, go. Shoot, shoot, shoot. We need this out right now. And it was like, I don't know anything about the video game, and okay, whatever, it's my film now. And yet, the end result being total shite.
Yeah.
And, but, I will say in its favor, it is almost so bad it's funny.
Mm-hmm. See, because, I haven't seen it in a long time, so, and I'm sure it's one of those so bad, you just, you know, it's hilarious and you just can't take your eyes off of it. But for most people when they first saw it, you know, it's like, what the hell am I watching?
Oh yeah, totally. It's not an easy film to watch, but there's reached a point when there's just so much slow-mo bullet time, so many plot holes, so many bad conversations, so many laughable dialogue that becomes funny. But there was only one problem. Uwe Boll realized it was funny. Mm-hmm. So he created and I kid you not, this is a real DVD, House of the Dead, the funny edition, mm-hmm. where it doesn't really add that much. It changes out like the guns with like water guns in some scenes, and there's a whole lot more nudity. Mm-hmm. Uncomfortable nudity. Which just makes the film much worse.
Like Dave Foley and Postal uncomfortable nudity?
About on par with that.
Oh, wow, okay.
Except throughout the whole film.
Oh, right on.
Yeah. It's comedy! Yeah, no. But that film really did kind of screw him over in a lot of ways. Because, well, after that it wasn't really much... luck after that, because his next film was yet another video game adaptation,
Alone in the Dark. Let me just say, I don't think I've seen the entire movie all the way through. I tried to watch it on TV or something once. I made it about halfway through and fell asleep because it was so boring.
Yeah.
And then I have since seen the rest of it, especially with the help of Nostalgia Critic and their look on it. But, man.
Now, did you see it on TV, or did you see the unrated director's cut?
It was like a movie channel. It wasn't,
It was the TV version. Yeah, because the funny thing is the original edition of the film is... I mean, both editions are crap. I mean, they're both essentially crap films. But because, I mean, if the Alone in the Dark video games, I'm sorry to any fans, they're not interesting. They're just really boring. And so I guess in a way he was doing it justice because the film was really boring. I mean, there were some interesting parts, but that opening dialogue thing, I mean, I know Nostalgia Critic covered it on his, but it is. It's really long. Unnecessarily long. And it kind of ruins any kind of mood or tension he had going in. And then the just for most of the film, even Brendan Fletcher's little cameo he had it with the whole cab driver thing, there's really no tension in the film, you know? You never feel like Edward Carnby's in any danger.
And
It's just like,
this is the first film too, I believe, where he does kind of his signature. It's so dark you can't see a damn thing that's going on.
yeah, I mentioned this in my Far Cry review. There are a few things that qualify as a Uwe Boll shootout. It has to be loud, it has to be fast, it has to be in slow motion, and it has to be completely in the dark. Why? No one knows,
Yeah,
but that's just how it
and
works.
if you haven't seen any of these Uwe Boll films, we don't mean that, it's just in the dark, the lights are dim, but you can still see what's going on. No, it's like that,
Pitch black.
yeah, it's pit like you can't see a thing.
Yeah.
It's just like they shut off the visual and all you get is the audio.
The
It's
audio, and then a couple flashes, flash
yeah.
bulbs. And
Like in Equilibrium, the scene where he goes into the room and has the shootout with the guys,
yeah.
but not nearly as stylish and interesting looking.
And with Rob Zombie blaring over the background of it.
Yeah.
But and then I mean, how can you make a good film when your three actors are a Jack Nicholson impersonator, a drunk party girl, and a guy who's never made a good film? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. Although he did make a director's cut, and one of my big complaints with the film is that they, for an R-rated horror film, there really wasn't that much gore or violence or tension, but nope. Well, what he does is in the director's cut, he pretty much gets rid of Tara Reid. That's the bare minimum. Gets rid of the sex scene, gets rid of pretty much most all of her parts, and it's just mostly just like, oh, she's there. Does she talk? Nope. No, just keep going. Keep going. Because he really didn't want Tara Reid in the film, apparently. He was really didn't like her. And they kind of cut out some of the big filler parts, like just like the big the things that slowed down the film, and replaced it with like aliens biting off people's faces. Like if you saw the picture on my review, like literally ripping out half of a person's head.
Right
I
on.
mean, the acting's still total crap,
Yeah.
and the writing is crap, but considering, I'd say it's a lot better. And we're gonna mention the next film that he did later, but his next film he did after that one was another video game film, In the Name of the King, a Dungeon Siege Tale. You know what? No. Nope, I pretty much said in my review, I'm skipping it. No, it's crap.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one, so I have no comment on it.
There doesn't need to be a comment. There is nothing you can really talk about. The acting is wooden. I mean, King Burt Reynolds.
Yeah.
Ray Liotta looking like Liberace. I mean, like, and there are some lines that are so predictable that I was sitting there saying them. Like, look, I was like, it's like the king gets poisoned and he like drops, and then John Rhys-Davies comes around and he's like, he has this really distraught look on his face, and I'm like, the king has just been poisoned. The king has just been poisoned. Whatever shall we do? Whatever shall we do? I'm like, Oh, and speaking of damning films, Seed was his next film.
Oh, wow. Was it that early on in his career?
It was right after In the Name of the King. It was shot back to back with Postal.
Oh, okay.
2007.
All right, then. I.
I'll let you handle this one because you have a lot of opinions about this one.
Yeah. All right. Forewarning. I'm what I'm going to do is read my review that I did on my own blog. Because it pretty much says everything that needs to be said about this movie. And if you're listening to this at work or somewhere public, I would kind of turn the volume down just a little bit. Okay. Ahem. Fuck the animal violence footage. Fuck the nearly non-existent yet simultaneously confusing-ass plot. Fuck the illogical actions by the zero-dimensional characters. Seriously, no backup, no officer down. Oh, and why not try to execute him one more time before you faked his death anyway? And more, so much more. Fuck the you can't see shit because it's too fucking dark cinematography through the entire fucking movie. Fuck the editing. Fuck the characters who you don't care for because you don't even know their names, much less anything else about them. Fuck the incredibly pointless hammer scene. Fuck the ending. Fuck Jodel Ferland's agent for allowing her to be in this movie, as she's the only talent in this piece of shit, and she was only about 12 at the time. Fuck Uwe Boll, who lost any semblance of respect he had garnered from me over the last few days after watching this quote-unquote movie. Fuck Uwe Boll again for making me actually say the following. This movie makes Hostel seem like the fucking Godfather, and we know how much I loathe Hostel and its stupidness. Fuck anybody who thinks there's any minute of this film that's good or entertaining, even if it's in a so-bad-it's-good way, because it isn't, and they're wrong, and they lose any kind of credibility as a movie commentator by saying otherwise. And finally, fuck this movie. Peace out.
So how do you really feel?
I made another comment at the very bottom. I said, and no, it wasn't because I found the movie hard to stomach or anything like that. We all know I love horror and gore. After the PETA footage at the beginning, I was fine. It's just a really, really bad movie.
Yeah. But it's just, you know, and if you read my review when I first posted it, yesterday, I was kind of more, I don't know, enthusiastic about the film, but it was one of those things where it's like, I like Uwe Boll. He's a nice guy. He either makes really so bad they're funny films, mediocre films, or really good films, especially now. And yet, here's this film that is just nihilistic, totally nihilistic, uncaring about anything in the world. It's unrelenting. The baby scene goes on for 10 minutes. I mean, you know, the dog, it's like five, you know, it's like 3 minutes and then the dog dies. The cockroach is very like fast paced. And even the girl, even the grown girl, it's like just a few minutes. But no, the baby is like, I was just like really starting to lose it because it's just like, okay, we get it. He's a horrible person. He's killing the baby very slowly by starving it to death.
Well, yes. Even the most nihilistic crap in this movie, like all the torture, all the horrible, evil, sadistic shit that he does in the making of this movie, I could forgive if it was made competently, which it was not.
Yeah, Hostel was made better. Yeah. I mean, you know, the funny thing about Hostel is once it picked up, it wasn't horrible.
Yeah, I've always said the last 20 or so minutes of Hostel is actually pretty decent. It's just everything else leading up to that. It's
the hour of
softcore porn.
Softcore porn and party boys that kind of ruin, and homophobic party boys that kind of ruins it. Yeah. But it's just, and do we even know any of the characters' names besides Seed? Because they only say really his name as far as I know.
They say the cop's name, but I don't remember what it is.
It's just it's sad because it's like you don't know any of the characters. And you know, the hammer scene, mm-hmm. which we've brought up a few times, and I brought up when I bought it in the hall. It was $1. Give me a break. Mm-hmm. It's one of those, hey, you want to see the worst movie ever? Here you go. Well, one of the. I still have feelings about two other films that are the worst films ever made.
we'll get to one of them later.
Yes. The other one I'll have to review. The other one I'll have to review eventually to just unleash my feelings. But it's just the whole film, just there's no point to it. in the hammer scene. I mean, if it would have been a character we would have known.
Yeah, it's just like, some random woman.
Random old lady. Hey, random old lady. How are you doing, random old lady? We'll never see you again. Oh, by the way, while you're saying the Lord's Prayer, he's going to take a hammer and just take the next 10 minutes to just hit you repeatedly with the hammer. Slowly. But surely.
Yeah.
About the halfway point, she's already dead.
Yeah.
And it's over. It's over. There's no point for him to keep going.
And at that point, it just turns from, just killing to pointless, stupid, crappy CGI.
Yeah.
Like, the head becomes just like the CGI head that's just flopping all over the place, and it looks so crappy.
Yeah, it does. It's... And what the sad thing is, around the last 9 minutes of the film, trust me, I was counting. last 9 minutes of the film, it actually kind of, I'm not saying it's getting good, just bear with me. It gets to the point where it's like the tape gets delivered to the cop, and he sees it's his house, and he runs over, and he's looking for his family, and then he drives over to C's house, and then I'm thinking, okay, there's some tension, there's some, suspense. What's happening to his family? And then he gets in the room.
Yeah.
Any semblance of plot whatsoever that was just here has just disappeared.
Yeah, and I was even confused because when he goes into the bathroom or whatever and sees the cop like brutally
chopped up
or whatever, I was like, who is that? Is that like his wife? I had no idea.
Well, it's such bad CGI and blood effects that it's like, nope. No idea.
And it made me wonder. I'm like, well, why isn't he even checking to see if the cop is there? And then, of course, it makes sense later when you realize it's the cop that's dead. But there's not enough detail in the scene for you to realize that it's the cop.
Yeah. And then it's pretty much just, no, please. I love my family. No, 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 lock. Yeah. The end.
And it tried to have that Saw kind of ending, where...
Okay, that's just an insult to Saw.
It is. I mean, not the twist where, it was the guy on the floor the whole time kind of thing, but where the bad guy wins and you get locked in a room to die. Yeah. That ending.
And here's the thing is... I mean, the Saw movies are brutal. Mm-hmm. And they do have the gore. And they have some real nihilistic tendencies, but the difference between Hostel and See, those films, and Saw has, believe it or not, Saw actually has a continuing plot that actually grows and has characters, even slightly, that you care about somewhat, even for the 10 minutes they're on screen. I mean, Saw is like Citizen Kane compared to these films.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I'm the first one to admit the Saw films aren't the greatest, but I love them because they take this genre that otherwise is full of crap and it makes it seem classy, I guess.
And, well, the continuity alone in the Saw series.
I don't know how they keep up with that.
Yeah. The scene that upset me the most in this movie, and I was talking to Travis about this yesterday, wasn't even, the disturbing shit, like the baby or the PETA footage at the beginning. And for those of you who don't know what we're talking about when we say, like, the PETA footage, Uwe Boll actually got real footage of people killing, abusing, torturing animals.
Experimenting.
Yeah, animals. Like dogs, mostly.
And that's the first 3 minutes of the film.
God, it seemed like 10.
First three.
Yeah.
3 minutes and 22 seconds. If you want to go watch the film, you can count for me. But 3 minutes and 22 seconds of animals getting tortured with a flash to Max going, a party.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, it's not fake. It's actual animal abuse footage.
Lassie.
Yeah. And anyway, back to my point. It's not even that footage that upset me the most. So that was kind of an upsetting bit of the movie. It was the scene. There's a very confusing set of flashbacks. You have no idea if it's going on at the same time, if it's a flashback, what the hell is going on, because there's no indicators. But it is a flashback of when they first capture Seed at his house. And there's, I think, like five cops or something like that who go to the house, and they're searching around, and it is pitch black. The only thing that lights this entire segment, and it's like, what, a 10, 15 minute segment? Something like that. Is their flashlights and the cop sirens lights outside. And this is actually, I thought, could have been a really good concept, a really good idea. Uwe Boll just handled it so poorly. You couldn't see anything. When Seed is about to attack the men walking through his house, it's just like you only see him for about half a second, and after the person is dead, so you don't even get like the benefit of seeing the death.
He doesn't even kill all of them.
Yeah.
He like sets up one that's like a total exact ripoff of one of the traps in Saw 4.
Yeah.
The kind of, well, spike thing to the head.
Yeah. And, I mean, it's, if he could have handled the lighting of it better, where, you know, the flashlights maybe went to certain corners of the room where you see Seed, but the cops don't, or something like that. And on top of all this, the cops are the stupidest fucking idiots in the world. After the cop, and I said this in my little mini review earlier, but they're walking around the house, they see the other cops dead. Do they do what cops always do and get on their little walkie-talkie or whatever and say, "We need backup," or
officer down. Yeah.
No, they don't. They just keep looking through the house. They don't even try to get in the car and go away.
No, because that would mean that the fodder would just keep on living.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think I know why he did it, and I'm not trying to justify it, but I think the one scene where the guy, where it was just all you could see was the flashing of the sirens,
mm-hmm.
and, like, it keeps flashing, and then see it appears on the last one.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was the whole point of that scene, where in terms of the why he chose the lighting was that one frame.
But he could have done that through, like, the whole scene.
But he didn't.
Yeah, but he didn't. And also, the, it's not in this scene, but it's what I consider one of the biggest plot holes of the entire movie, which is when, the electric chair scene. And the rule is, apparently, if you survive three attempts in the electric chair, you go free. Well, they get through two of the attempts, and Seed is still alive. And so they tell everyone else that he died, and so they leave. And then they kind of conspire in the back and say, well, if we do it one more time, we'll have to take him to the hospital and then he'll be free to go. If we don't do anything, we'll pretend he's dead and we'll just bury him alive. First problem, why not try to do the electric chair again? Everybody else thinks he's dead by electric chair. If they're going to lie and break the law and bury him alive anyway, why not try to just kill him via electric chair anyway?
I have a question.
Yeah.
Why not shoot him in the head?
That was my issue number two.
They are all armed.
Why not
shoot him in the head? Yeah. He's dead already to everybody else. Just shoot him.
They're breaking the law by burying him alive anyway. Why not just shoot him in the head? If they're not going to even attempt the third electric chair, jolt, which would have been the legal way to try.
Because the movie would have ended.
Yeah.
The movie would have ended 45 minutes into it.
Which would have been lovely.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, really the last thing I want to mention again, I briefly mentioned it in the review. Jodelle Ferlin, I think that's how you say her name. She's a child actress who really first kind of came to light in Silent Hill.
Oh yeah, that's the little girl.
That's a little girl. She's been in a few things since then. Seed, one of them. And she's actually a really good little actress. If you've seen Silent Hill, she's great in Silent Hill.
I'll admit, even though I didn't like the film, she was really good.
I like Silent Hill, except for the ending. But,
oh, yeah.
But, yeah, this, why? Why put her in this movie?
Because she gets paid, and all she really has to do is sit there, eat cereal, and then walk up later with the detective, and then say probably one of the most predictable lines I've ever heard in a horror film. I had a dream you died.
Yeah.
I'm like, no, you didn't. I mean, that's like, the king has been poisoned. It's like, oh, jeez. You can't have a horror film without saying, I dreamed you died, or something like that in there. Nah.
Yeah, I, when she first came on screen, you can't hardly see her because, like...
It's so dark!
It's very dark. This entire movie is pitch black. Like, it's not just the action or murder scenes, like, the entire... Except for the hammer scene, which I guess was supposed to be the centerpiece of the movie. Like, everything is pitch black, and it's ridiculous. But anyway, when she first came on screen, I was like, no, that's not her. Yeah. And then you see her little... That is her. Damn it. Why?
Yeah.
But anyway, I think we should move on from Seed.
Well, and I don't have much to say about the next one because I have a little more to say about the one after. Is his next film that he shot back-to-back with Seed was Postal.
Mm-hmm.
You apparently didn't like Postal all that much. I thought it was just a stupid, silly shooter.
I didn't hate Postal. I thought it could have been much better than it was. It had some really good moments in it, particularly the first 20 or so minutes.
One thing that had me rolling was the cat silencer.
The cat silencer.
I love that because it's in the game and it's one of my favorite things in the game. And then they're just like, he's just like, I'm just like,
yeah, the two parts particularly that I liked the most, was the opening where it makes fun of the 9/11 terrorists.
Yeah.
Because I just thought that was funny in a very tasteless kind of way, but it was still funny. And then the next scene, which I think is the best scene in the whole movie, is the interview scene. Where
that's a good scene.
Yeah, he goes in to get a job interview. And first thing he notices is a bunch of fake severed heads on the wall. And then he sits in the chair and the chair is broken, so he's wobbling all over the place. And then the manager, who's played by, what's his name? Rick Hoffman, who you'll notice in a lot of things. Usually...
Hostel.
Yeah, like Hostel. I would say usually like horror movies like Hostel. Or other just kind of really bad movies. But he's a really funny actor, which surprises me. I love it when he's in a movie. Like, he always makes that scene better.
Yeah.
Even if it's, like, the crappiest movie in the world, he will always make that scene better. Mm-hmm. And, anyway, there's just a bunch of silly interview questions that I just found hilarious, especially because since I had to go through an exhaustive job search process about a year ago. and...
They didn't ask you what was the difference between a duck.
Yeah, that's my favorite line in the movie. What's the difference between a duck? And then he's just kind of, what? And then just goes off on them both. And it's a hilarious scene.
I love, and I don't like the nudity part, but I do love the whole doomsday cult thing that Dave Foley's got and that mumbo-jumbo religion he's got. And one of my favorite scenes was the Ufa Bowl, the Nazi theme park.
Yeah, I gotta admit, that was a good scene where Uwe Boll makes his cameo appearance.
And, well, if anything else, he gets shot in the balls.
Yeah.
I mean, he's in Lederhosen, and he gets beat up by the guy who created the game and shot in the balls. I mean, how many people have wanted to see that happen to him?
I mentioned in my Seed review where I said Uwe Boll lost any semblance of respect that I gained for him over the last week. That quote-unquote respect came from two different movies. The first was Postal, in this scene, actually, where he makes fun of himself, which I thought was, you know, it was really funny. And he takes stabs at himself, which, you know, takes balls. And the other one was Blood Rain, which we'll get into later.
Yeah. This film reminded me of was just like South Park, just like live action. Well, not even the good seasons, but just kind of like the medium kind of
season. Oh, and Rampage. How can I forget that? But we'll get to that later.
And I'll briefly touch on his other greatest film.
Yeah.
Which, but it's definitely, I didn't hate it. This will be the start of the line from Casablanca that they stole at the end was funny. And they're running hand in hand with the bomb exploding. His next film was the sequel to Blood Rain, Blood Lane 2 Deliverance, where, Zach Ward again. Zach Ward plays Billy the Kid, who's now a zombie, and has a posse. And Rain is played by a different actress. And she gets her ass handed to her, and then Michael Paré, from Seed and every other film he's done, just shows up and is like, hey, you want to team up? I got this preacher guy, and I got this Franson guy, and, us four, we can take down Billy the Kid and save the children.
Yeah.
Okay, well, the funny thing about that film is it is one of those so bad it's funny, but more so than any of his other films.
Mm-hmm.
It's just there are so many laughable parts that as a comedy, it's like Snakes on a Plane. As a comedy, it's great. As a serious film, which it's trying to be,
Now, did he actually do Blood Rain 2? Did he actually direct that?
He directed Blood Rain 2. He handed over the Alone in the Dark and House of the Dead series to other people, but he always had an affinity towards Blood Rain.
See, I thought he... Oh, no, I'm thinking of the actress. Okay.
Kristanna Loken just dropped out.
Yeah.
What I considered this was Uwe Boll's Room. This was his The Room film.
Blood
this
Rain 2?
Yeah, was his the so bad it's...
I want to say that about Blood Rain 1.
Well, you can say that about Blood Rain 1, but if you see Blood Rain 2, it's definitely the Wild Wild West. Rain in the Wild Wild West.
Okay.
Oh, boy.
Next.
And his next film we'll get into later, Far Cry, which I have more nice things to say about. And then his...
What about the whales?
That was his comedy. That was his comedy.
Oh, yeah. Moving on.
And then, his last four films that he's done, well, his first one was Tunnel Rats, 1968, it started a little trend that he did, which was improv films, letting the actors improv whatever. He would write the script or he would write parts of the script, but then he would just decide to put them, just like let the actors do whatever naturally came to them. Tunnel Rats, it's a Vietnam film. There have been a lot of Vietnam films throughout the years. It's not Apocalypse Now or anything, but it does have a really good message of like the futility of war and that sometimes, no matter what happens, in the end, sometimes people don't win.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, war is a very violent and brutal thing. And what I like is you actually care about all the characters, all three trucks full of characters you care about. And when they die, you're like, oh, you're like, you really care. Then his next film, which I consider to be his second greatest, is Stoic. Which, yeah. I almost thought it was better than Rampage in some ways. What Rampage is they take Edward Furlong from...
You mean what Stoic is?
Yeah. What?
He said what Rampage is.
Oh, I meant Stoic. Sorry. Both... Yeah, never mind. Well, they got Sean Sipos, Sam Levinson, and Edward Furlong, and one other guy who's kind of a nobody. And what happens is this film is based on events that happened in 2006. Not like, see, this is based on true events or whatnot, but this is actually something that happened in a German prison in 2006. Four prisoners were locked up for 23 hours a day, day after day after day together. And it was very cramped, very not a lot of room. So what would they do? They would sleep, eat, talk about how badass they are. And their big pastime was playing poker. Well, one day, they start doing bets. And the smallest guy, Sean Sipos' character, Mitch, he's kind of this youngest. He's the smallest and I'm guessing probably the weakest. And he loses a bet. And his penalty, you have to eat a tube of toothpaste. Okay. An entire tube of toothpaste. Now, that seems kind of like a juvenile thing, but he wants to kind of keep this bravado, this badassery he has, so he doesn't do it. Well, the other three didn't take too kindly to him saying no, so they made an example of him. Yeah, it's... I don't want to ruin the film, but it's really hard. It's like watching the prison scene in American History X all over again. I mean, it's like seriously just it's just not pretty. It's not like seed brutal for the sake of being brutal. You care about all the characters, mm-hmm. all four of these guys. But you know that three of them are doing horrible things to this one guy. But what's interesting is they intercut these interview segments. Like, they're kind of treating it like an interview. Like, this is like a... When they're getting like, well, why'd you do what you did to him? And they're kind of like... They're explaining their reasonings behind it. So, intercut with all of it, you see like... Them all talking, like Edward Furlong says, you know, you tend to look at us as we have the same sort of rules that apply to the outside. They apply here. Well, they don't. They simply don't. And it's a great film. And I definitely recommend it.
Moving on to Rampage. Which I think, and so do many people, is Uwe Boll's best film. And it's actually a really good film, believe it or not. It's about this kid named Bill, played
Bill
by...
Bill Williamson.
Yeah, Bill Williamson, or William Williamson, if you put it all out there, played by Brendan Fletcher. And he has like a really kind of twisted, demented mind, because of, basically, it's like he watches too much news, and everything is all like nihilistic, essentially. It's all depressing, the world is shit, and it's kind of twisted his mind. And one day his parents decide that it's time for him to move out and move on with his life, and he's like, well, okay, if it's kind of a big bomb to drop on me right now, but, you know, whatever. And he continues on with his day, and things start, you know, shit just keeps happening to him. He goes to a coffee shop, and the coffee guy refuses to get his order right, and then refuses to refund his money. And then they go, him and his friend, who is just, like, kind of the stereotypical college, you know, libertarian, you know, anarchist kind of.
Yeah.
You know, and he, they're talking about, you know, how the world is fucked up and everything like that. The waitress screws up and, like, dumps the food all over him. And anyway, point being, not all of this actually has anything to do with why he goes on his rampage, but I mentioned it because it has purpose in things he does during his rampage.
And basically what happens is during all this, he keeps a basement full of guns and Kevlar and this, like, full-body Kevlar vest, and that's kind of a Kevlar vest outfit mixed with paintball, mixed with pretty much steel plates, anything, you know, he can get his hands on so he can't get shot from anywhere. And he just... And eventually just one day he's like, yesterday was a bad day, and I don't need any more bad days, and I don't need... And then he just starts... He just loses it, just completely cracks at the seams, starts working out crazily, just frantically punching anything, and he's like, his parents leave the house, and he's just like, okay, all right. He just suits up, and then from there...
Well, see, I don't even think he loses it, really. He keeps his cool for almost the entire movie, and... He does work out a lot, and he's kind of intense during that, but you can tell, like, if you kind of read between the lines, he's been planning this for a while, and it wasn't just because of that previous day. And, you know, it wasn't that next day simply because of what had happened to him, because, and this is kind of a spoiler alert, he planned his friend to be in the forest to play paintball with him on that exact day because he wanted his alibi. And well, you know, not a little more than an alibi.
But so, still, it was kind of like he had been planning this for a while, but I think really for him, when I say he cracked, I don't mean, like, just totally went gun crazy. I mean kind of like Dexter cracked. Mm-hmm. Like, you'll notice on the show Dexter, every now and again, he stays really cool for the most part, but every now and again you can see just... I'm talking about less in his actions, more just you can tell in his mannerisms and just the way he walks and talks and moves that he's just, like... He's just in a totally different mindset. Just this calm insanity.
So pretty much what he does, he suits up and gets all his guns and goes around town and just, like, starts killing people. Like, just randomly, he'll choose people and just start shooting them.
Well, not before blowing up the police department.
Yeah, he blows up the police department. He also robs a bank. And then supposedly takes all the money and dumps it out into a trash can. And
burns it saying, I don't need your money.
Yeah. But this is really all of another major master plan that he has, which I think is the smartest aspect of the movie. Not just the social commentary that it has, which is good, but it besides a social commentary kind of movie, it's still smart and entertaining in this kind of perfect crime kind of aspect that he's trying to pull off.
Yeah, there were two scenes in particular that really, during his rampage, one was the hair salon.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I mostly say, like, he was, like, really, you could really tell that he was in a different mindset, because he was still that calm, you know, he sat chill, took off his mask, you know, in the corner, and just sat there. But then when when the women started talking, he was like, cheep, 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 and just like...
The Tommy Wiseau, cheep, 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 cheep.
Yeah, he was doing the cheep, cheep, cheep at them. Just, like, at their direction. Yeah. And it was kind of funny, but at the same time, it was really disturbing, because you knew what he was going to do.
Yeah.
You know why he was there. You know he couldn't let anybody live his hot face.
Yeah.
And you knew, you were just waiting, but you could tell that he was just having fun.
Yeah. Well, and then, but at the same time, he was kind of conflicted because he comes, like, he leaves, and then he comes back in later, and he goes, well, why did I do that? Why did I take off my helmet? You know, et cetera. Just kind of arguing with himself. And it's kind of like a twisted little moment right before he kills the women.
Yeah, and then he just mows them down. And then the other side of the spectrum was the other side I was seeing I was going to mention, which was the poker room.
Mm-hmm.
The bingo room or bingo hall or whatever.
Yeah.
I really thought he was just going to go in there and just blast away, but it was interesting. It's almost like the thought I had or like the thought process I was trying to get in his mind a little bit while I was watching was they don't notice a guy in a full Kevlar vest holding guns.
Mm-hmm.
These guys are dead already. They're dead on the inside. You know what I mean? It was kind of like they weren't paying I mean, he was standing there reading off, 25. You know, like, he was just...
Then he sat down with them, made a sandwich.
and it's like... And none of them noticed. And I think at a point, when you saw him when he was walking out, he's kind of looking at him, kind of just, like, leaning over.
Laughing.
Yeah, it almost really did seem like these people are dead on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
There's no point shooting him.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? It's just kind of like he was methodical about it all, it seemed.
We are kind of saying how great this movie is, but I do want... There is some negative to it, mostly in the editing.
Mm-hmm.
At least for me, there were some things about it. Two main things, really. First is that... the kind of the flash forward and flashback cut-ins. It's really strange, Uwe Boll's decision to do this. During the first, I don't know, 20, 30 minutes of the movie, before he goes on his rampage, there's these intercut scenes, clips, of him already on the rampage and just, like, shooting down people. And I guess it's trying to show, like, how his mind is working and how he's planning everything. But it didn't work for me, especially later when he's already going on his rampage and then it flashes back to when he's just normal and doing his own thing.
The flash frames did bother me. Another thing that kind of bothered me, and it doesn't really bother me about his films because Uwe Boll does it in all of his films, is the camera work.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, whoa, like, it's never still.
Yeah.
It's just like it's always, always moving, always going.
Yeah, the other really weird thing that bugged me is for about the first 5 minutes of his rampage, all you see are his eyes. Like, the camera is just on his goggles, and you hear like the muffled shooting, and it's kind of quiet. You hear the screaming and all that, but you don't see anything. It's just like his goggles, and that's it. And that really annoyed me.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, well, it's still an Uwe Boll film. There are still going to be irks about it. But as an Uwe Boll film, it's his best film.
Oh, by
but
far.
But also, as just a film in general, it's a good film.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's only 82 minutes long.
Yeah.
It's not a very long film. And it does take a while to set up. I mean, the first 33 minutes are the setup. But then from 33 until the end of the film, it's pretty much just boom, 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 boom. You know, it just keeps going.
Yeah, and the setting up does kind of get redundant at times, like with the working out scenes. But it's still good. And he's not like your stereotypical, you know, angry, I want to kill the world kid. He's perfectly normal with his parents. Like, he doesn't yell at them. He just has normal conversations. He apologizes when he screws something up. And he's sincere about it.
And he even calls them during it saying, are you guys okay? Are you guys going to stay, you know, where you're at and not going to do anything? It's like, yeah, okay, cool.
I think part of that is he didn't want them coming home and realizing he wasn't there.
Well, I think also he really, I think, does love his parents.
Yeah.
He wouldn't want anything to happen to him.
Yeah.
Anything. He wouldn't want to have to do anything bad to him.
Yeah.
Because he really does love his parents.
So...
And then his last film that he made, he's making a few films now, currently a Darfur film, a Max Weinberg film, and an Auschwitz film, but his last film he did recently was called The Final Storm, which was just crap.
Yeah, I've heard that's like a return to his like shitty self.
No, and here's the thing. The film is like Tim Urban's last weeks on American Idol. Huh. He does really well for 3 weeks and then disappoints.
Uh-huh.
Like, here's the thing. The first half of The Final Storm is good. It's really good. Before the storm happens, the so-called final storm happens, it's really good. It's this kind of like post, it's like this kind of mid-apocalyptic climate change. The economy's gone totally to hell. Things are on fire. People are rioting in the streets, going crazy. And here are just these two people on a farm just trying to make it through all of these bad things going on in the world. And it's a really good story that they have, kind of thriller, kind of 28 Days Later minus the zombies. Is kind of
no zombies.
Hmm?
No zombies.
Well, rage victims. There's no rage zombie. Well, rage creature
infected,
you know. Yes. But there's none of that, but there's a lot of bad things going on, lynchings, hangings, mobs, all that. Then the storm happens. And what I said is the writer, Tim McGregor, that's another problem, is Uwe Boll did a film where he didn't write it. It was written by Tim McGregor. And he's a competent writer. Like I said, the first half's pretty good. But then he hits the money shot way too early. The film, the final storm happens. And then he realizes, well, that wiped out all of humanity except these three people. Okay, we could, you know, discuss the biblical allegories and the biblical, you know, messages within it. And yes, okay, there's a few biblical messages. And oh no, we're gonna turn into a slasher horror Last House on the Left film. Okay, all right. Okay. You know, it completely takes a total theme turn, gets rid of any kind of semblance of a idea of a story they had here, and just turns it into a slasher Last House on the Left film with three people.
All right.
And No. you wonder.
Yeah.
Although I will say I am looking forward to definitely his Max Weinberg film.
All right. We should probably move on to the D-bag because we're kind of running long.
Yeah, I don't know. But that's pretty much an overview of his career.
Yep.
Basically, here's what the D-bag was. We kind of mixed it together. But, all right, here's what people said about Uwe Boll. Kai Parker said, "I don't like his films, but you have to respect his attitude and tenacity." I definitely see that.
Okay.
Jason Soto said, "I hated Alone in the Dark, really hated House of the Dead, and strangely enough, like Postal. I like weird tongue-in-cheek humor and dark humor, so why not? Plus, it stars the bully from A Christmas Story, so there's that." Didn't even notice that.
Yeah.
Then Simon mentions, "I've seen nothing of his to speak of." And Rachel says, "I haven't seen any of his films, but I remember that ranty tape bitching about Michael Bay and laughed my ass off." Yep. Yeah, his little back and forth with, Michael Bay has been pretty funny. Him calling Michael Bay the worst director. That should tell you something.
Yeah.
All right, but that's it for the D-bag. So now moving on to film versus film. And we got rid of genre change. So
yeah.
So for this week's film versus film, we're doing Blood Rain versus Far Cry.
I'm taking Blood Rain.
I'm taking Far Cry. Okay.
Yeah, kind of set up here. Travis loathes Blood Rain with a passion, and I enjoyed it.
J- Just watch the video on my.
Yeah. And Far Cry had some moments, but I think Travis far enjoyed it more than I did. So.
Yeah.
All right. Again. 1 minute for introduction on why our film is better. 3 minutes counter and 1 minute conclusion each.
Okay. All right. Here's the thing about Far Cry is Far Cry, the film, is based on a game that really didn't have much of a story besides guy goes around shooting stupid people for the most part. It's not really that much of a deep story. It's just kind of an action film kind of story. So you'd think that it would, you know, relate really well in an action film. And I think for the most part, it does. I mean, it is an Uwe Boll film, so there are problems with it. But for the most part, it just has that nice, mindless kind of action that I like. The characters don't really need to be all developed in anything, and what I think works is that there's some good comic relief moments, the action's pretty good, then it's just it really does, I think, work as a film, or at least as on par with a lot of the other action films that are being released, not like Expendables, whatnot, but like on par with a lot of the good direct to DVD films that we've definitely seen. That's my time.
All right. Blood Rain. What can I say about Blood Rain? Blood Rain is not a good movie by any means of the imagination, but it is so freaking entertaining. Everything about it is just so bad that it is, it's almost intriguing in how Uwe Boll could not have known that this was a bad movie when he was making it. Part of me thinks that he knows it was bad and he embraced its badness. And it is so bad that it is hilarious. The action scenes are so over the top and silly. Like, the blood is overly fake. The wigs are ridiculous. And Billy Zane is like the best actor in the movie, which should tell you quite a bit. And his character has no purpose. It's just bad, and that's my time.
Okay. All right, here's my thing, is Blood Rain is just, it's a terrible film. Nick's not denying that it is a terrible film, because, I mean, just look at it. Rain has a tramp stamp lower back tattoo. There's the black powder China thing that, you know, people were using guns by then. If you can look, you can see the glint. She's wearing contact lenses, and there you see people wearing modern day watches every now and again, and Rain has this really weird tan, like she's been out in the sun for a long time, and yet last time I checked she's a vampire. And then you can see blood coming out from underneath people, and you can obviously tell it's a blood pack, and the weapons are blunt. You can tell, I mean, they're not even trying, and it disappears and reappears at will, and her cross never stays in the same place. I mean, I understand she's moving, but it never stays in the same place even when she's standing still. And I mean, I understand films that are trying, that, you know, are so bad they're funny, but I mean, unlike films like The Room or Manos or Plan 9 or those kind of films, this one's just, it's not that fun. I mean, with Far Cry, it's not the greatest film, but you get some good action, you get explosions, you get slow-mo fight scenes. I mean, it's on par with like a lot of Steven Seagal direct-to-DVD films. You get a guy who can barely speak English fighting other people and just causing explosions. And I mean, if you go into this thinking there's needs to be a lot more, then there isn't. It's a good, entertaining action film, while Blood Rain is just, it's so bad, it's painful. It transcends so bad, it's good. It's just, it's painful. I mean, it's I really don't really have much more to say than it's just, there's really not much redeemable anything about the film whatsoever. And I regret watching it. I regret owning it. The only good thing about it is the commentary, which just proves that Uwe Boll was just completely mad when he was making this film, and I hate him for it.
All right. Far Cry. Yeah, it has some action, but the action is boring. And it, the, the actor, he's not funny. He's trying too hard to be funny. He can't speak English. The comedy that the movie tries to have is so ridiculously stupid that it's more painful than funny. But George, what about the whales? It's not funny. It's bad. It's not even so bad it's funny. And the acting is so poor. The plot is ridiculous. When it gets to the point where they have to kill the super soldiers, the super soldiers have Kevlar skin, yet they're wearing Kevlar bulletproof vests while the normal soldiers are not. That doesn't make any logical sense. When they shoot the super soldiers in the eye, it's ridiculously stupid looking, and overly fake. Like, you can tell they just kind of took the latex and just kind of cut it, and there was your effect. There was almost every time the movie started to try to do something good, it found a way to mess it up. And at least Blood Rain had, it was so poorly executed throughout. The difference between Blood Rain and Far Cry is that Far Cry was inconsistent with its badness, but Blood Rain was so bad all the way through that it was entertaining to watch. I wasn't conflicted in my loving of its terribleness. Its tone was there, and it was set, and it was just there to be laughed at. Far Cry just tries too hard. It has good ideas, but just a really poor execution. Blood Rain is just bad all around, but it's so bad, it was just done on purpose. And it's just hilarious. The script is cheesy and fun, and like there's no contractions, and just trying to hear Michelle Rodriguez do a British accent is like the funniest thing in the world. And that's my time.
Okay. Alright, here's the thing about Blood Rain. For me, is that it could have been so bad it's funny, but the script is just so poor all around for me. Not in the ho-ha-ha kind of the room kind of ha-ha bad, but just in the it's so confusing and they try to do too much and try to be too serious about it, and then you kind of get, well, what are they talking about? You know, if you didn't play the games, then you had no idea what they're talking about, while Far Cry is just, there are super soldiers. They are evil. Here's Till Schweiger, and here's this Valerie girl. They're on the island. Boom, 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 boom. And that's the whole movie. You never have to question anything. Yes, there's continuity errors and whatnot, but that's Uwe Boll. He always has been doing that. But what just makes it awesome is that it does. It just feels like a great direct-to-DVD action film, and that's my time.
All right. Blood Rain is just... It's an excellent, so bad it's good movie. What's his name? The bad guy... Yeah, Ben Kingsley is just, he doesn't even phone it in. He's so boring in this movie, and it's just funny because you know he can act really well, and just to see him doing this is excellent. Michael Madsen in that ridiculous wig, how can you not laugh at that? And, you know, Kristanna Loken, you get to see her boobs, and I think that about wins my argument alone. let's see. It's Meatloaf. Meatloaf Day. His whole scene is just so ridiculous that the action, the killing, like you said, that all the weapons are blunt instruments and they're killing each other, and it's so over the top, and that's my time.
All right. That'll be an interesting one to see people judge.
Yeah.
It's boobs versus...
Jason will be so conflicted.
I know. Explosions, boobs. Explosions, boobs. I don't know. Okay, so I guess that moves us on to our mono dialogues of the week. You going first? Do you want me to?
You go ahead.
Okay, well, since my computer really hates me for some reason today, I'm not allowed to do any other monologue except this one, which is Monty Brogan from 25th Hour. Now, mind you, there is a little bit of language in here, so this is probably going to get an explicit rating, but I tried getting something else, but my computer froze and our call dropped, so I'm like, you know what? Fine, I'll do it. But I don't want to say the F word 45 times in 5 minutes, so I may take, and then, because it takes a while for him to, like, say it, so I may put just F this in some of them. But on the ones where it's more defined and bold, I will say it. But gotta do it for the kiddies. All right. Yeah. Fuck you too. No. Fuck me. No. Fuck you. Fuck you and this whole city and everyone in it. Fuck the panhandlers grubbing for money and smiling at me behind my back. Fuck the squeegee men dirtying up the clean windshield of my car. Get an effing job. Fuck the Sikhs and the Pakistans bombing down the avenues in decrepit cabs. Curry steaming out of their pores, stinking up my day. Terrorists and effing train is what I think it is. Slow the fuck down. Fuck the Chelsea boys with their waxed chests and pumped up biceps, going down on each other at my parks and on my piers, jingling their dicks on my Channel 35. Fuck the Korean grocers with the pyramid of overpriced fruit and their tulips and roses wrapped in plastic. 10 years in this country, still no speaky English? Fuck the Russians on Brighton Beach, mobster thugs sitting in cafes, sipping tea in little glasses, shark cubes between their teeth, wheeling and dealing and scheming. Go back to where he fucking came from. Puck blackhead at Chasidem, strolling up and down 47th Street in their dirty gabardine with their dandruff, selling South African apparel diamonds. Fuck the Wall Street broker, self-styled masters of the universe, Michael Douglas, Gordon Gekko, wannabe motherfucker, figuring out what new ways how to rob people blind. Send those Enron assholes to jail for fucking life. You think Bush and Cheney didn't know about that shit? Give me a fucking break. Tyco, WorldCom. Fuck the Puerto Ricans. 20 to a car, swelling up the welfare rolls, worst fucking parade in the city. And don't even get me started on the Dominicans, because they make the Puerto Ricans look good. Fuck the Bensonhurst Italians with their promenaded hair, their nylon warm-up suits, their St. Anthony medallions, swinging their Jason Giambi Louisville Slugger baseball bats, trying to audition for The Sopranos. Fuck the Upper East Side wives with their Hermes scarves and their $50 Belushi artichokes, overfed faces getting pulled and lifted and stretched, all taut and shiny. You're not fooling anybody, sweetheart. Fuck the Uptown Brothers. They never pass the ball. They don't want to play defense. They take 5 steps on every layup to the hoop. And then they want to turn around and blame everything on the white man. Slavery ended 137 years ago. Move the fuck on. Fuck the corrupt cops and their anus violating plungers and their 41 shots standing behind a blue wall of silence. You betray our trust. Fuck the priests who put their hands down some innocent child's pants. Fuck the church that protects them, delivering us into evil. And while you're at it, FJC. He got off easy. A day on the cross, a weekend in hell, and all the hallelujahs of the Legion of Angels for eternity. Try 7 years in effing Otisville, Jay. Fuck Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, and backward-ass, cave-dwelling, fundamentalist assholes everywhere. On the names of innocents of thousands murdered, I pray you spend the rest of eternity with your 72 whores roasting in a jet fuel fire in hell. You towel-headed camel jockeys can kiss my royal Irish ass. Fuck Jacob Ensley, whining malcontent. Fuck Francis Fravier, Xavier Slaughtery, my best friend, judging me when he stares at my girlfriend's ass. Fuck Natural Rivera, I gave her my trust and she stabbed me in the back. Sold me up the river. Fucking bitch. Fuck my father, who has endless grief, standing behind that bar, sipping on club soda, selling whiskey to firemen, and cheering the Bronx Bombers. Fuck this whole city and everyone in it. From the row houses of Astoria to the penthouses of Park Avenue, from the projects in the Bronx to the lofts in Soho, from the tenements in Alphabet City to the brownstones in Park Slope to the split levels in Staten Island, let an earthquake crumble, let the fires rage, let a burn to fucking ash, and then let the waters rise and submerge this whole rat-infested place. Now. No. Fuck you, Montgomery Brogan. You had it all. And you threw it away. You dumb fuck. Scene.
Nice.
That'll get an explicit rating.
Yeah. I think we already kind of had one, but, you know.
Oh, I think that kind of just added it.
Yeah. I am doing kind of the opposite of this. And I'm doing a scene from Man of La Mancha, starring Peter O'Toole. And for those of you who do not know, it is the kind of the musical version of the story of Miguel de Cervantes and Don Quixote. So here we go. Oh, and to set up the scene, Miguel de Cervantes is in a prison, and with the Spanish Inquisition, and he's put on this play of Don Quixote, and this is kind of a ways into the movie, and one of the men in the prison is questioning his beliefs, and then the character of Quixote himself. So, this is Cervantes talking with this other man, whose name I can't remember at the moment. All right. But you see, Cervantes, there is a difference between reality and illusion, and a difference between these prisoners and your men of lunacy. I'd say rather, men whose illusions were very real. Much the same thing, isn't it really? Why are you poets so fascinated with madmen? We have much in common. You both turn your backs on life. We both select from life. A man has to come to terms with life as it is. Life as it is. I have lived for over 40 years, and I've seen life as it is. Pain, misery, cruelty beyond belief. I've heard all the voices of God's noblest creature, moans from bundles of filth in the streets. I've been a soldier and a slave. I've seen my comrades fall in battle or die more slowly under the lash in Africa. I've held them at the last moment. These were men who saw life as it is. Yet they died despairing. No glory, no brave last words. Only their eyes filled with confusion, questioning why. I do not think they were asking why they were dying, but why they had ever lived. When life itself seems lunatic, who knows where madness lies? Perhaps it is to be too practical as madness, to surrender dreams, this may be madness, to seek treasure where there is only trash, too much sanity may be madness, and maddest of all, to see life as it is and not as it should be. I am Don Quixote, the Lord of La Mancha, destroyer of evil am I. I will march to the sound of the trumpets of glory forever to conquer or die.
Well, you had to throw in that musical number there at the end, didn't you?
I did.
Good. All right. Well, I think that about does it for this week's episode. Hope you all enjoyed. We kept it under 2 hours.
Yeah.
So that should be pretty good for all of you. But I think we're going to sign off now. I have been, always will be, Travis McCollum.
Were Nick Jobe.
And this has been the Demented Encyclopedia. Thanks.